We begin our look at Maeve Brennan, fittingly, in Ranelagh, Dublin. Actor Eamon Morrissey is currently on tour with Maeve's House, which refers to the house in Cherryfield Avenue, where both he and the writer lived. Zoe Cummins reports.
From the time I was almost 5 until I was almost 18, we lived in a small house in a part of Dublin called Ranelagh.
Maeve Brennan's short story, The Morning After the Big Fire, was utterly familiar the first time Eamon Morrissey read it.
In 1966, I was in Philadelphia. Here I Come, on the first production in New York, and I was going into the theatre and reading a story in the New Yorker magazine, and the hairs on the back of my neck started to stand up because it was literally too close to home.
On our street, all of the houses were of red brick and had small back gardens.
I hadn't realised the story was by Maeve Brennan, and it was a story about the little house I was brought up in Cherryfield Avenue in Ranelagh, because my parents bought it from her parents when they moved to Washington in 34.
Our street was called an avenue because it was blind at one end, the farthest end from us.
I think, although Maeve Brennan never wrote directly politically, I think she does see that Cherryfield Avenue as a cul-de-sac, as a dead end. It's where lives, where dreams faded away and people just settled for their mundane lives.
Whilst in New York, Eamon met Maeve in the Russian tea rooms.
I knew exactly what I was to look out for. I was to look out for a small, sophisticated New York lady with a mass of red hair. And she did. She had her hair up in her favourite beehive style. Dark glasses, lots of makeup, and a bit too much perhaps. I wondered what her initial assessment of me was. I mean, with her powers of observation, she could have read me, write me down and write me off in about 10 seconds flat, but she wasn't at all like that.
The Visitor, Maeve Brennan's only novella, was written in her 20s, and for Eamon it was eerily prophetic.
And the awful thing I find right through her writings is that she seemed to foretell in her earlier writing what was going to happen.
Beloved images rise up in disobedience and make a mirror for emptiness.
It almost foretells how Maeve Brennan, the real Maeve Brennan, is going to wind up.
It is a silly creature that tries to get a smile from even the most familiar and loving shadow. Comical and hopeless, the long gaze is always turned inwards.
And that was Eamon Morrissey talking to Zoe Cummins there with readings by Catherine Walker. Now, to discuss her life and work with me in studio is Angela Burke, author of Homesick at the New Yorker, and Ellen McWilliams of the University of Exeter, who's been writing about Maeve Brennan's work. Angela, for anybody who doesn't know who Maeve Brennan is, who was she?
She was an Irish writer who spent most of her life in New York. She was born in 1917. Her father was very active in the 1916 Rising, and he was actually in prison in England when she was born. And they went to America in 1934, as Eamon Morrissey said in that piece, because Bob Brennan, having lived a fairly modest life as a journalist and then latterly as manager of the Irish press, he was suddenly co-opted by Eamon de Valera and sent to Washington as a diplomat. And he became what was called the Irish minister. We didn't have an ambassador because the Irish diplomats still took their credentials from the Court of St. James in London before the Irish Republic. But Robert Brennan became the Irish minister in Washington. And because of the war, because the war broke out in 1939, he didn't come back as he might have done after a few years. So Maeve went there at 17 with the rest of her family, and she, instead of going to UCD as she had planned to do and becoming a librarian, which was one of her plans, she became, you know, a diplomat's daughter attending college in Washington. And then in her early 20s, she left Washington for New York. She had terrific contacts through the diplomatic world, and she found a job at Harper's Bazaar, which was edited by an Irish woman at the time, Carmel Snow, born in Dalkey, and a real dragon, a real sort of Devil Wears Prada kind of editor, a formidable person. But she trained Maeve. She trained all her journalists in very precise writing. So Maeve Brennan is in New York as a young woman in her 20s, working for this very, very glamorous magazine. And she's learning the craft of writing, but she's also writing fiction. And it's for her fiction that we really remember her. She was employed by The New Yorker from 1949, moved there from Harper's. But the fiction is what lives on. The fiction, even though she was a reviewer, even though she was such an observer of New York life, the fiction is a unique voice. It's a completely unique take on Ireland and on wealthy New York as well from an Irish woman's perspective. But it transcends place. It's really about the human condition. It does what all great writing does. It tells us more about life.
Ellen, I'm always interested in how people discovered Maeve, because she was so under the radar, particularly in Ireland anyway, until almost a decade after her death. How did you discover her, and what was it about her work that made you realise that she was such an important writer?
Well, I discovered Brennan when her work was reissued after her death, but I have to say I really came to a full appreciation of who she was and her place in a larger Irish cultural history through reading Angela Burke's Homesick at the New Yorker, which is such an important recovery project. It not only gives us the fascinating details of Brennan's life, and hers was an extraordinarily complex and fascinating life, but it also gives us models by which we might read Brennan. And when I think about Maeve Brennan, what emerges is a figure of remarkable courage and intelligence who established her place amongst a New York literary elite and held her own at every turn. I think she also offers a particularly important case study of the Irish woman migrant in the mid-20th century. You know, as recently as the 1990s, the Irish woman migrant was still, as one historian put it, the great unknown of Irish emigrant history. And the recovery of the story of Brennan's life is a significant part of that history, partly because of her success as an Irish woman writer in New York, but also because even though she herself was a daughter of relative privilege, in some of her more satirical stories set in New York, she writes with extraordinary wit and sympathy about the experiences of Irish women servants in the middle-class American home. And I think in that regard, she shows herself to be keenly sensitive to the histories of her less fortunate immigrant foremothers and immigrant sisters.
Angela, Ellen mentioned the idea of the immigrant writer, and a lot of Irish writers were writing for the New Yorker at the time, like Frank O'Connor and Mary Lavin. And Maeve was very, you know, she was feted and championed at the New Yorker by William Maxwell. He was a friend, he was a mentor. But what was it he saw in her fiction that made her different to those other Irish writers contributing to the magazine?
Well, I suppose those other writers had first reading contracts by which they were paid a retainer, and anything they wrote went to the New Yorker, and the New Yorker then got first refusal. Maeve was in a different position in that she was a salaried employee. She had her own office in the New Yorker. She was part of that world. She was part of the coterie that went around the corner to drink in the Algonquin Hotel. She was a kind of successor to Dorothy Parker, sitting around the round table at the Algonquin. And they had a watering hole as well, not far away, in an Irish pub that was just a couple of blocks away from the New Yorker office. So she wasn't just a writer sending in her work to William Maxwell. She was somebody who was present physically in the building. And the building, you know, one woman who worked there later described it as being quite reminiscent of a university building. In other words, it was very grey and masculine in its whole layout. It was about getting the job done. It was kind of clubbish and an old boys' network. But Maeve came in there and she painted the office, and she painted the ceiling of her office Wedgwood blue. She always had fresh flowers in there. She always wore perfume, and it was wafting along the corridor before her. She always wore high-heeled shoes. And everybody who has written about her, or people who talked to me about her when I was researching my biography, talked about just her presence. They said, you know, if you heard laughter around the water cooler, it was probably something she had said that had made everybody laugh. So she took on all these men, you know, famous men, really well-known people like Charles Adams, who invented the Adams family, the cartoonist. These were the people who hung on her every word, who loved her, who were her friends and her drinking companions and her mates.
Angela, you paint a really vivid picture of her, and I know that Ellen, she published 41 stories at the New Yorker, and people have this idea of what Maeve looked like and how she acted and how she spoke. But let's talk a bit about the work. I mean, in terms of the stories and the themes, what did she explore in that writing?
Well, as Angela said, there's a very real precision and striking elegance in all of her writing. But there are also a number of key preoccupations that she does seem to return to again and again in her work. I mean, first of all, her relationship with place, her relationship with Dublin and New York is so interesting. In one of her letters to her friend Howard Moss, poetry editor at The New Yorker, she writes, "No place is home. It is as it should be." And there are moments in her work where she seems to embrace an idea of rootlessness, a notion of being the traveller in residence, as she puts it. But at the same time, it's very clear that Dublin and New York are cities of vital importance in her writing. The Springs of Affection is, of course, the collection made up of stories of Dublin, as the subtitle goes, and it's a full of carefully crafted and intimate stories of the lives of Dublin families. But I think she claims New York City in a much more immediate and direct way by lovingly mapping the city in her Long-Winded Lady columns.
Well, can we talk about that, actually, that sense of place in the Long-Winded Lady columns, Angela? Because it's not just the people she's observing, it's everything. It's the temperature, it's the buildings, the street, the noise, almost the weather.
It's the lights as they go on and off, and the way New York remains like a stage waiting for actors to come on stage. She observes these tides of people. You know, in New York, they talk about the bridge and tunnel crowd, the people who come in every day. And New York has so many tourists. And she writes about just these lives. And she says, and it's one of the lines that Eamon Morrissey uses in his play, that the windows of small restaurants are the home fires of New York City. These are the kind of themes that she uses. She's, in some ways, you know, it's interesting that her Dublin stories, they do kind of form a counterpoint to Joyce's writing, as you were saying earlier. But where Joyce's people are all outdoors, Maeve's Dublin stories are all indoors. It's the politics of the family. It's the architecture of the house. It's the way tiny, long, brewing tensions kind of fester among people. But then when she gets to New York, it's all outdoors. It's all the life of the streets. It's the public being in a city. And I think in some ways she made a trade-off because she was such a dedicated writer. She traded domesticity, a home life, the kind of life that her mother had had, which in some ways she would have absolutely hated, but the life that her sister had, for instance, with four children, she traded that for her own authenticity as a writer. And by doing that, she put herself out in the street.
Well, I think recognition for Brennan's work as a writer has increased both here and in the US in recent years, so much so that there is a walking tour and a tour that really captures that sense of New York. It's dedicated to her, and Zoe Cummins went on the tour with its creator.
Our friend the Long-Winded Lady has written to us as follows. We've received a letter from our friend the Long-Winded Lady. After an interval, we've heard from our friend the Long-Winded Lady, who writes, "So began many of Maeve Brennan's pieces for the Talk of the Town section of the New Yorker."
We're currently in Washington Square Park on the west side, which is just across the street from what is currently called Hyden Hall. It used to be the Holly Hotel, which is one of the first places that Maeve resided in New York City when she arrived.
So we go and have a little look at that now?
Yeah, sure, let's go.
Jen Brown of the Irish Arts Centre in New York has created Walk of the Town to celebrate Maeve Brennan and the places she lived in the city.
That was probably one of the most fun parts of researching it, is I'd read all her stories and like I had a map of Greenwich Village, and then I went through and like marked out places that I'm like, I'm pretty sure she's talking about this.
Maeve once referred to herself as a traveller in residence. She moved around New York to places like the Earl Hotel, now called the Washington, which is part of the walking tour.
So a lot of the places that she either lived or stayed do still exist, but they have a different name, or they've become something else, or they've been knocked down and rebuilt. So
it's quite a nice place to live, looking out over Washington Square, which has a literary past in itself.
A huge literary past, a huge political past.
She wrote for the New Yorker magazine under the moniker of The Long-Winded Lady, and her articles are acute observations on the city.
So we are off to what is currently the New York Studio School on 8th Street. It's mentioned in one of Maeve's stories, 8th Street has changed and changed and changed again. A lot of her writing touches on New York City as it's sort of changing, and her sort of thoughts and feelings and reactions to areas being demolished to, you know, build something bigger, brighter, and more glossy.
Well, absolutely. And as we stand here today, you know, the change is happening, because you can see in front of us that there's a huge building, and there is it's a construction site, essentially. There's a lift, mm-hmm. and it's hauling rubble down, and it's bringing blocks up, and New York City is getting higher and higher and higher each year.
Yep. And you can see that in the Long-Winded Lady entries, where she sort of is lamenting the changes.
Maeve called New York the most reckless, most ambitious, most confused, most comical, the saddest, and coldest and most human of cities. But it allowed Maeve to live in a way that she wouldn't have been able to in 1950s Ireland.
Based on what I know of Ireland at that time, I just don't think it would have been the same. I don't think she would have had the same sort of independence or the same kind of lifestyle. So I think once you come to New York, it's really hard to leave it. It's always sort of chasing you, calling to you.
And that was Zoe Cummins talking to Jen Brown, who runs the Maeve Brennan Walking Tour in New York. Angela, to go back to your own book, Homesick at the New Yorker, was Maeve lonely in New York, and was writing a way of writing herself out of her isolation, do you think?
I don't think that her writing was a response to isolation. I think her isolation was a response to her writing. I think she was such a dedicated professional. She saw herself as being in the tradition of the great Russian writers, the great French writers, the great Irish writers like Joyce. She was very gregarious in the sense that she was often with people, but she was also extremely private, extremely elusive. People would invite her to a party and she would not show up, or she would mysteriously leave. She has a beautiful piece about a cat called Bianca, and it's all about how if she had known what had happened to Bianca, that things would be okay, or if Bianca's owner had known what had happened to her, he could have perhaps forgotten this cat who disappeared out of his life. And Maeve was in a lot of ways like that cat. She did her own thing. When you ask if she was lonely, I think the price she paid was very high, the price she paid for her dedication to her writing, because she was working and living in a man's world. And these men who lived the life of the office and the bar and the Algonquin Round Table and the drinking clubs of New York, they went home on weekends or they went home late at night to families in Connecticut or in upstate New York very often. Maeve didn't go home to anybody. She was married very briefly and quite disastrously to a fellow New Yorker writer who was actually, I think, bipolar, and who spent all the money, not only that they had, but that they could conceivably earn in their lifetimes. Because the New Yorker was a very generous employer and it used to allow them advances on future earnings. But I think Maeve felt that she had to divorce this man when it seemed that she was going to go down, when his ship sank, as it was inevitably going to do. So she didn't have a domestic life. She didn't have a husband. She didn't have children. The men that she consorted with, and again, I think she didn't have as many lovers as she was reputed to have. Several men in their 80s at the New Yorker, when I interviewed them about Maeve, said to me, I think I was the only man who wasn't her lover. So she was desired and dreamt of, and she certainly did have close relationships with some of these men, but not with all of them. However, she didn't have any place to go home. She didn't have a domesticity that she could return to. She didn't have a wife.
There's a lot of domesticity in the stories, Ellen. And I think while Maeve is predominantly known for her columns and her short stories, some of the stories in The Springs of Affection seem to fit together like a novel almost. Was she considered in any way experimental? Was she doing anything in her writing that other writers weren't?
Well, I think she was, especially for an Irish woman writer writing in that period. If you think about how the poet Austin Clark looks back to Joyce and Yeats and talks about his own coming of age as a growing up in the shade of an oak tree, you know, Maeve Brennan would have had to find her own way of coming to terms with that formidable legacy. And different Irish writers in the period responded in different ways to those formidable precursors. You have Flann O'Brien cutting Joyce down to size in a kind of affectionate way in his writing, especially in novels like The Dawkey Archive, and Patrick Kavanagh giving us The Stony Grey Soil as a kind of answer to Yeats's pastoral vision. But I think this is one of the reasons why Dublin and New York are so important to Brennan's writing, because New York is to some extent the place that she escapes to, but she takes a lot of Dublin with her. And for example, I came across a letter which I thought was very telling on a number of levels, a letter that she wrote home to her husband, who was in New York at the time when she was on a visit to Dublin. And she tells him about various things that she's found in the city that have been of interest to her. She's been out shopping one afternoon and came across a Bawneen jacket and is very pleased with this. But she also notes that she's discovered a coat in a shop that she describes as a Rathmines version of a Dior design, and imagines that she'll bring this coat back with her to New York. And I think in some ways that as a story and as an anecdote about who she was and the things that were important to her day to day, it is quite revealing, because she is a truly transatlantic writer. She's a writer for whom Ireland matters as much as America does. And what's very interesting is the way in which those two worlds encounter each other in her stories. And I think that's one of the things that makes her truly innovative.
Can I ask you both as well, because there's an awful lot of, when people talk about Maeve Brennan, they focus a lot on the end of her life and the tragic end to her life in lots of ways. And it sort of overshadows the writing and the work. How do you feel about the way she was represented at the end of her life? And you deal with this in the book, Angela.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to escape. And if you're writing a biography, obviously you've got to write what happened. And it was a New Yorker writer called Mary Hawthorne, I think, who first really, well, William Maxwell did as well, but Mary Hawthorne was a a writer who wrote about Maeve after she died and about encountering her when she had no idea who she was, when Maeve was she was really not much different or not very many steps up from a bag lady, living mostly outdoors and quite confused, quite dishevelled. And Mary Hawthorne didn't know who she was and made some inquiries. And she's the one actually who found these wonderful photographs of Maeve Brennan taken by Carl Bissinger when they were both working for Harper's Bazaar. She's the one who found this amazing persona that Maeve presented in the 1940s when she was so groomed, when she was so beautifully turned out. But the thing that distresses me, I suppose, for Maeve, because I feel that I know a lot about her life at this stage, is how public her later years had to be. You know, we talk about, say, domestic violence among poorer people and how visible that is among travellers, for instance, or something, whereas domestic violence among better off people is behind closed doors. And Maeve's disintegration and her later years were lived in a kind of horrible glare of publicity and were commemorated because, of course, she was living among writers. They were commemorated. She, I think, was quite comfortable in her later years, but it's certainly true that after the Vietnam War, when, you know, when the culture changed, when she was in her 50s, she didn't really change with it. You know, Ellen was talking about her as a transatlantic writer, and really her heyday was the day of the great ocean liners. And she was born for ocean liners. She was on her first one at 17, and she came back and forth across the Atlantic many, many times on those liners in that elegant world that they produced. And even the early days of air travel, again, suited her down to the ground. But then when air travel got a bit more common and when it was easier to come back, somehow she lost the petals, or she didn't manage it so well.
Well, we've talked a lot about Maeve and her life and her writing. Let's hear a section from The Long-Winded Lady.
The woman was standing on a traffic island in the middle of Broadway and 45th Street. She was singing "Bei mir wisst du schon" at the top of her lungs. She was blind drunk. She screamed the words in a hoarse voice and kept time with her umbrella. As she sang and waved, she did little bumps and grinds. There were three people on the traffic island besides the drunk woman. The three of them were just as much afraid of her as they were for her, fearing she might fall forward under the wheels of cars. Long-Winded Lady had seen her a few minutes earlier, on the east side of Broadway. A respectably dressed, middle-aged woman, but very drunk. When the light changed at last, a taxi drew up alongside her, and as soon as it had stopped, she slammed her umbrella down flat on the top of it. The driver held on the umbrella, asking her to let go of it. Long-Winded crossed the street and went into a bookshop. She wonders about the woman and how she came to be helpless like that in public, wondering how much of all this she will remember tomorrow.
Thanks to Ellen McWilliams and to Angela Burke, whose biography of Maeve, Homesick at the New Yorker, is about to be reprinted. Maeve's short stories, The Springs of Affection and The Rose Garden, are widely available, as is her novella, The Visitor, which is next week's Book on One on RTE Radio 1. And we'll be putting all of the books we discuss on our show on our website.